Well, I don't know if your qu answer to this question is going to be very long. What was Ali Campbell like at school?
Ali and Brian and Earl introduced me to reggae, introduced me to Trojan and Jamaican reggae, and at a time when I was playing Ziggy Stardust, you know, and they said, "You should listen to this. This is proper music. This is reggae." And he was, Ali was, they all were rebels, you know, they were gone by the fifth form. Whereas I was a girly swat who hung around and did bloody exams. They were out of there, hence the name UB40, but they were rebels, weren't they? Rebels, you know, that they, I don't think they enjoyed school. I enjoyed school, I had a laugh. But they, I don't think they enjoyed school. They wanted to be out and doing something else. They just loved, all I know is they loved reggae. It was all reggae, you know. They breathed it.
Okay.
Even though Ali's dad was a folk singer.
Oh.
A Scottish folk singer, so it didn't come from him. You know? It came from the culture of Borsalid in Birmingham, which is
yeah,
more Jamaican than Irish. You know?
When I was chatting to Neil Dawson, he mentioned that you got into a fight with Clive Pickering, not you fighting each other, but you were playing pool and there was a fight. That sounded like a really interesting story. Is it an interesting story?
It's true. I don't know whether it's interesting.
How did you get into a fight in beside Clive?
I wasn't fighting Clive. The reason we got into a fight was twofold. One, because of lager. And two, because Clive is the best pool player I've ever seen in my life. So something awful had happened, and me and Clive decided to go and take the afternoon off, as was our wont in those days, and drink. I think we were BMP at the time. And we went drinking for a whole afternoon. But the trouble was, the drunker that we got, the better that Clive got at pool.
Yeah.
So we went into a bar, and he kept winning. And then people started putting money down and saying, "Roll along, I'll play you for a tenner," and he would just win. And then they wasn't a pleasant bunch, and they turned on Clive, and they thought we were ringers, is what happened. They thought we were gone in there to their local to rip them off because we were actually pretending to be drunk and we're, you know, professional pool hustlers. Nothing could have been further from the truth. So a fight broke out and we had to defend ourselves. I'm a Muhammad Ali fan, so I know what.
Yeah, okay, talking of Muhammad Ali, boxing gloves. So there's a sort of, I don't know, apocryphal story or whatever, that you flew back from Cannes, bid on the boxing gloves and flew back to Cannes. What did you do? Because I've seen photos of the boxing gloves and you did a sort of exhibition of some of the things you've collected. Where are they now and what do you... Because there's a special energy to them, surely. They kind of need to be seen and experienced. Where are they?
No, you're dead right. They're in a locked case at the minute. But I think I've got the biggest Muhammad Ali collection in the world. And you're right, they do need to be seen. So my plan is to get a space, get a room, and exhibit the stuff. I've also recently bought the shorts from that fight as well. So yeah, we put on this exhibition last year at the O2 with Graceland. It was Graceland who put it on, and Elvis's people. And we lost Ali in the middle of the run of the show, you know. It's very special stuff. I exhibited some of it at Selfridges once under the title of Unholy Relics. Because I believe that there is a spirituality in things, and we're losing things. You know, we don't have love letters anymore. We don't have photographic prints anymore. We don't have records. We don't have anything. We don't have objects anymore. And I've always believed in a kind of medieval way that objects are imbued with place and person. And so I'm not interested in autographs in the same way, you know, but memorabilia is too weak a word for it. It's the stuff of life. It's quasi-religious stuff. And when we had the gloves at the exhibition, I got in a white kind of chapel-like room.
Yeah.
I'll send you the picture. And they're in a case with a spot on them, and they're on a white plinth. And they look quite organic, you know. And I've got about the robe. The robes. I mean, robe itself is a provocative word, isn't it? It's a robe, and it's got that incredible Ali logo. You know, he was a boxer, apparently, but he'd got the Muhammad Ali black, you know, cotton logo, Muhammad and then Ali across on the back of the robe. And I own that, and it's just an incredible piece. It's an incredible piece of typography. You know, it's just a great thing. And the fact that it's a robe, I don't know, it's imbued. I've had many people say to me, do you think in the future you'll be able to take the DNA sample out of the gloves and rebuild that way? You know? Of course. That'd be nice. If people are going to have their heads frozen, I don't think it's as far-fetched as that. Yeah. So, yeah, Ali is... massive in my life, massive, because he transcended. All my heroes transcend what they were supposed to be, you know. Ali, you wouldn't describe Ali as a boxer. It's like describing Nelson Mandela as a politician, you know. Ali changed everything. I went over to his funeral in Louisville, and it was a great, uplifting, spiritual affair. You know, it was an old school jazz kind of soul funeral. It's a parade. It was, people were crying, but they were singing, you know. It was a special buzz. I'm so glad I went. Yeah, special man.
Great. And you mentioned, again, I'm just going to take little words out of what you're saying in other subjects and go, Selfridges, how did you persuade them to have a placement team in their window for a while? Because I'm going to interview John Allison, I can ask.
It was Chris and John, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Well, because I've always believed in putting everyone on anything. And so when we pitched for Selfridges, the placement teams worked on the pitch, the youngsters worked on the pitch, the oldsters worked on the pitch. And the campaign idea was cracked by Jay Trott, who's Dave's daughter. Mm-hmm. And it was a great idea. And so I said, right, if we win this, we're going with your idea and yours alone. So if you win this, you obviously you're hired because they'll pay your wages. So that's it. We won the business. She got hired. That was great. And then we had such a great relationship with that client that went right up to the top to this crazed Irish-Canadian fella, the family who own it, actually. And I had a really good relationship with them. And they're genuine innovators, and they're obsessed with those windows. You know, those windows are 100 years old. Mm. At the time, they were the biggest windows in the world, I think. And people used to promenade up and down Oxford Street and look in those windows. They're probably still there. And they came up with the idea of, well, you can have a window. What would you put in a window? And we put that brief out, and I think, you'll have to ask the boys, but I think it was Chris and John who had the idea that, well, we'll go and crack a brief. I mean, again, ahead of its time, because right now what would have happened is people would have tweeted the brief in or tweeted the ideas in, and then they would have responded live time. Yeah. It was almost that, but not quite, because that wasn't quite evolved then. But they were in the window cracking a creative brief live, if you like, in a kind of David Blaine style-y.
Yeah.
But what we didn't realise is it would be 147 degrees centigrade, so they nearly died. I'm sure that they'll tell it much better than I do, but that was the story. Great client.
That's excellent. And while we're in the world of advertising, I just wanted to know, because I spoke to Nigel about what it's like having 50 DNAD entries in a year. What's it like being the CD in the agency when that happens, and also when Mountain happened? Because those two were of such huge successes in terms of creative awards and that kind of thing. What's it like being the guy in charge of the agency when such, you know, huge honours, you know,
it was like the bloke being in charge of Chelsea or Arsenal, as you might say. I don't know. It was like being the gaffer of a brilliant football team. I mean, at TBWA we had at one time about 35 creative teams, maybe more. And all of them have now got their own agencies or, you know. Bill said a lovely thing. We went to DNAD, God, about 5 years ago. And we're sitting there watching people collect awards. And Bill nudged me and said, have you seen what's happened tonight? I don't know what you mean. He said, look what's happened tonight. I don't know what you mean. Everyone who's gone to the stage tonight and collected a pencil used to be in our department at TWA. And it was lovely. It was lovely. And so at the time, they just got very competitive. So Nigel and Paul were always going to hoover up all the print awards, you know, and then Ed Morris was going to hoover up the television, and Paul Stillman was going to go big on television. And yet they all wanted to win each other's awards, you know. So Paul would always say, I'm going to get a trophy for print this year. And I'll always remember that when Nigel and Paul won at, I think it was Campaign Press, and they just won everything. And it was for probably Waterstones. Yeah, it was Waterstones. And they'd won everything. And then they said, and the Grand Prix of the night is... And it's this Waterstones ad. And I went, go on, boys, go get. And they said, no, you're coming with us. I went, bloody hell, go get it. He went, no, you're coming with us. So I go up to the stage and they collect this Grand Prix. And as we come down off the stage, one of them, I won't say which, went, prats. I said, what, what's wrong? Fucking prats. What? Well, they picked the wrong ad. This isn't the Grand Prix. Said, the other one was much better than that. Being really critical of the judges weren't as smart as they were, because there were five ads and they picked the wrong one for the Grand Prix. What the fuck do they know? They're just judges. And I just thought that is absolute pure perfectionism, that they weren't willing to go, happy days, Grand Prix, let's cheer. It was, no, that's a downer because they picked the wrong ad. What do they know? It was just amazing. It was an amazing time. And PlayStation was probably the best client I've ever worked with. You know, I was talking about that at lunchtime, funny enough, because if you ran those ads now, they would cause a sensation. If you ran ads directed by David Lynch or Chris Cunningham now, they're more than valid now. But to go into a pre-production meeting with David Patton, who was the client, who's now the fella at Grey, and Chris Cunningham, I had to speak for him, you know, he was the shy lad in the corner. I'm not exactly loud myself, and Chris sat in the shadows, and he had a drawing of our alien girl, and I had a poem that I'd written that that's what she's going to say, you know, and that's it. That was our pre-production meeting, and you know, and Chris, and David Patton is saying, what have you got then? I said, well, I've got a drawing. Chris has done me this drawing, and he just done this cartoon drawing of what the girl's going to look like, and then I would read out the words I've written, mental wealth. And he went, this is going to be extraordinary, isn't it? Let's go and make it. And we did, you know. And the same with Mountain. We had a giant piece of paper. It was so crude, but everything seemed so crude. Same with Double Life. With Double Life, the boys, we were working on a Sunday, and the boys came to my office on a Sunday, and they'd written Double Life. They'd written it on a bigger than A2, on a piece of paper on the floor. They'd written the monologue for Double Life. And I said, that's it, we'll just stop now, because that's it, it's crap, we'll just make this. And we got on to Frank Budgeon, and then we got on back to David Patton and said, OK, David, brace yourself, we've now got an even bigger piece of paper with a poem on, no cartoons. And Frank, bless him, another great loss. Yeah. Frank's gigantic contribution to the music is always overlooked as well. So on Mountain, it was Shirley Temple. And then on Double Life, it was a Requiem. We would never have thought of that, either of those tracks, actually. And so with the Requiem, Frank changed one. He changed one line at the end of that script. It now says, because although I've led a double life, at least I can say I've lived. And originally it said, although I've led a double life, at least I can say I've lived one. It's no contest, you know. Yeah. And that was Frank's contribution. You just do that tweak. And what I will say is that shared monologue is now a disgraceful genre, isn't it? Every single charity ad. Yeah. And it's all done so fucking badly. And I just want to shake the screen, because this is how you do it properly. Well, you don't do it because Frank had the idea, so fuck you. But if you have got to do it, get every character to read the entire script, all of them.
Yeah.
Then it fits together. Then it flows. Then you'll find that the person you thought was going to read a line really well didn't, and he read this line better. Do it that way. And instead what happens now is people read their five words and then they stop. And then the next person comes on, reads her five words and stops. And it's stilted and it's ugly and it's... Oh, it drives me mad. If I put the television on there, one of them would come on. Usually for charity or Sky movies or something.
I think it's kind of amazing that the line "and conquered worlds" was the real anchor and bit that everyone remembers out of that. Was there something that...
It was the Irish boy. I'll tell you what it was as well. It was the Irish boy, Belfast lad. And what Frank did was undercranked or overcranked. I get mixed up. But it wasn't quite lip-synced. So he was saying it. He appeared to be saying it in slow motion. And he said it in a broken voice. And no, you're dead right. That was the moment. It was a real moment. And we invited that lad when we had the PlayStation launch. He came along, that lad. Yeah, I'm intensely proud of PlayStation and all of that work. It had a genuine impact, you know. To get David Lynch out to run in Coronation Street, you can't make that up, you know.
I was going to say, what's it like having, if Chris Cunningham's quiet at a pre-prod, what's David Lynch like during the process?
Brilliant. He's like a child. He's like Jimmy Stewart. He talks like Jimmy Stewart. Like a mad Jimmy Stewart, and it's all great. You smoke it up, driver. It's great, you know. And I got into trouble with him because I'm a big David Lynch fan. Blue Velvet changed my life, you know. And there was something I always wanted to ask him. So when we started working, we shot half of that commercially in his house in Beverly Hills and in Hollywood Hills. And there was a question I always wanted to ask him, and I thought, oh, I'll pluck up the courage and I'll just ask him, it'll be fine. Because I've always had this thing about Nicolas Cage. It bugs me, because I think he's the worst actor in the history of the world. Right? So I thought, how am I going to broach this? And it works with David, because on Wild at Heart, overacting isn't overacting, it's just a bit creepy, so it works. But in Wild at Heart, he was just terrible. And so I said, David, I've got a question for you about Nicolas Cage. And he said, yes, Nick, great, Nick, okay. I said, is he a really good Elvis impersonator, or is he the worst actor who ever lived? And David went fucking ballistic at me. How dare you say that, Trevor, how dare you? He is one of the finest actors I've ever worked with. I never want to hear that word. He just went at me. And do you know what? 6 months later, Nicolas Cage married Lisa Marie Presley. So I know I was right. I know what Lisa saw in him.
Yeah. And the fact that he won an Oscar. It is weird, Nicolas Cage. I mean, we could have another long conversation about this. He is a dreadful actor. And then I'm trying, like in Leaving Las Vegas, and he won the Oscar. I'm trying to go, is it that it was...
But wasn't he just an Elvis in that bloody film?
I know. And
not a coincidence.
Not only Elvis, like an Elvis on crystal meth. It was like...
Yeah.
I don't know.
I just think he's a terrible actor. But David wasn't happy about that.
Okay.
So he'd sit there on his high chair, and he had a big box of jelly beans, and he had a big megaphone, and he had smokes. He had his cigarettes. They've got that Indian, they're called Indian brand or something. They've got the Indian headdress. Anyway, he only smoked those cigarettes. So he would sit there going, smokes, we're having smokes and we're having jelly beans. Strange. I filmed it all as well. I've got a making of film, which is quite sweet, of that. Yeah.
Sounds amazing. Okay, I've got a question here that just because people might want to know, what does the chairman of an advertising agency actually do?
I've got no idea. And I've been chairman for most of my career. Because they made me chairman at TVWA when I was about 9. And I got loads of abuse in campaign for that as well, actually. People wrote in, again, letters page in campaign. I remember some kind of famous people in advertising saying, this is a bloody disgrace. You put a creative fool as chairman of the agency. What's the world coming to? And I remember writing letters back to campaign saying, well, I told my mum I'd been made chairman. And she said, well, do your best, son, do your best. So... You do your best, but you are the figurehead of the place, I think, is in short. I believe the creative editor should be that as well, but they're not always. Yeah. But a chairman can only be that, really. They imbue the spirit of the place. I think that's it.
Okay.
It's a good question. I don't know. As I say, that hasn't been mentioned for a few years.
Yeah, because David Abbott was of AMV, and I think it is a figurehead kind of thing where you're setting the tone, but it is unusual for a creative person to be allowed to be the real grown up.
Well, that's what got so much grief for it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even when Nils Leonard, you know, got some grief as well, because they made him chairman, I think, didn't they? I don't know why it's always an issue when a creative person gets made chairman. But it always has been.
Yeah. Point number 15, D-Day, because the thing I worked on with you, the only, because I've never worked in your agency, but tangentially we did a D-Day thing together. That was an immensely satisfying experience. But, you know, for anyone who hasn't been on the inside of working with you, I thought your passion for what was a really amazing cause was just incredibly inspiring. And I don't know if you wanted to talk a little bit about how D-Day or why D-Day. And
well, thanks for mentioning that, you know, because it doesn't get mentioned, and thanks for giving me the chance to, and thanks for the work that you did. In fact, only today, look, there's the work. Only today, I was digging out some materials for D-Day Fire, and that says, if it wasn't for the D-Day veterans, this ad would be, and the rest of the line says, spoken in German, but it's in German. D-Day is really important to me because I have no history of military in the family, but I'm a bit of a historian, and I believe that D-Day was the most important moment in Europe's history, if not the world's history, because if D-Day hadn't worked, Europe would have become entirely fascist, and Hitler would have cut a deal with America. And America would have said, you get on and be fascist and we'll be over here, but don't you dare come near us. And everything would have changed. And the fact that I can call those guys right now, I can call Ken Reynolds, and he's 94, I can call him today and talk to him about when he met Montgomery, just blows my mind. You know, he was Royal Engineers. He went down onto the beaches. Just for Christmas, I bought a flag at auction, which was the first... is a white ensign. It was the first flag raised on D-Day Beach by the British on the 6th of June. And I bought it, and I went to a Christmas dinner with the old boys, and I took it up there to show them. And I'm going to get it specially treated and put in a resin box, and we're taking it to Normandy in June because I want to take it back there, you know, for the boys. It's profoundly moving talking to them because they are heroes, and they're lauded as heroes. But when they go back, the only reason they go back is to honour the guys who didn't come back. It's like the ultimate gigantic decades of post-traumatic stress. So when they go to the Bayeux Cemetery, they find their friend. They find the grave of their 19-year-old friend who was shot beside them. And they know it could have been them. And they go and they put the poppy down. And it's just, whoa. And, you know, when we me and Eddie Izzard, Eddie's a mate of mine, and Eddie got so involved in this. He's brilliant. Eddie is a war historian. And in fact, I'm doing a wartime movie with Eddie in a few months' time. That's another story. But when me and Eddie go with them to Cannes, you walk down the hill through the village towards the beaches, and the French children say thank you in English. So as they're marching along, these little kids are shouting, thank you, sir, thank you. And they're sort of 5 years old. It just breaks your heart. It's just, wow. You know, me and Eddie are sort of looking at each other, losing it. And these boys are just, you know, 96 years old. They march down to the beaches, you know, and then for the rest of the year, they go back to being old boys again. You know, and we've vowed, me and Ed have vowed that when there's one Normandy veteran left, we will take him back to the beaches, but they love gallows humour, so whenever they remind me of that, we always say, the only problem with that plan is there's no fucking way on earth that me and Eddie are going to outlive them Normandy veterans. So, you know, on your bloody own, you know, and they love it. Whenever I see them, it's where's Eddie, you know. So I commemorate it every year. I fly them out there, you know. We did it big when you helped us out. That was D-Day 65, and that year we took nearly 800. We had a fleet of planes, and we took nearly 800. 600 made the march at Bayeux Cemetery, Sadly, there's only about 200 now. And every winter we lose more, you know. But we will always honour them. We'll always take them back. And we got so much help. People are so kind about it. You know, when we had that appeal, the Overlord appeal, you could sponsor a veteran to go, you know. Cost $300 to send one guy over. But no, it's something that has to be remembered. It's living history, and they'll be gone. They'll be gone really soon, you know, and then it's gone. And the things they tell me new stories every time I see them, you know. And it needs to be recorded. It needs to be down, you know.
Absolutely. Okay, well, we're getting to the sort of upper limit of what my website's going to put on there, but I thought we could end on one slightly more fun subject.
Good.
It's
all a bit heavy.
You created and, I guess, promoted a burlesque act in the...
I did.
Yeah, so do you want to talk about how that came about a little bit?
And now she's massive. Now she's the biggest burlesque act in Europe. Her name is Immodesty Blaise. Look her up. She's fantastic. You know when they say getting divorced and moving house and losing your job are like the three most traumatic things you can do? I beg to differ, because on the 5th of the 5th of the 5th, when we set up B&B, on the Tuesday, I resigned from TBWA. On the Wednesday, I set up at the opening night of the burlesque show, Immodesty Blaise and Walter. On the Thursday, it was the general election, and I'd done the election campaign for Labour. And on the Friday, I opened an exhibition of my memorabilia stuff at Selfridges, and at NAP on the Saturday. But I didn't know whether I was coming or going. It was just a complete nonsense. And we expected the burlesque thing to run for 4 weeks. It ran for 17 weeks, and it was lovely. And the reason I did it is because I went to see them. What's the place called? The Last Remaining Music Hall is on Kingsway on the way out of, forget the name of the music hall. And I saw this troupe of burlesque dancers one night, and I thought they were brilliant. I spoke to them afterwards and said, you know, you should go to the West End, you should do the West End. And they said, well, no, we couldn't, we haven't got a sponsor. I don't know what you mean, you haven't got a sponsor. I said, well, because Walton's, that's it, Walton's musical. We're up Walton's, everyone's drinking this gin because they'd sponsored it. And I said, we've got to do the West End. I said, we haven't got a sponsor. I said, well, how much would it cost? They told me. I said, well, I'll just pay it. So I'll be the sponsor, but you don't have logos over yourself. You just do it. Because all they wanted to do was dance. There's 30 of them in the troupe. They just wanted to dance, you know, and they were being stopped from dancing. So I said, well, I'll do it. Fuck it, you know, I'll do it. And it was great. And I took everyone I knew. Whenever I had to go out anywhere, I'd go, well, I fancy coming to my burlesque show tonight. It was just great just to go to this thing. And Immodesty has just become so big now. And I kept the Evening Standard Review. We got absolutely battered. They called it scene, filth, appalling. There's no nudity in burlesque. That's the idea. Burlesque is a political thing. And guess what? We were opening opposite Stringfellas. So that's okay then. So Stringfellas is fine, but ours is an obscene. And this is before Kylie Minogue and everyone else got burlesque, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that we were all ahead of our time on burlesque. We were ahead of our time by about 5 years, but it was bloody fun. It was really good. Really good fun. I forgot about that, actually.
Yeah. I think there's a whole bunch of things that you could pluck from the last 20 years that maybe you have like escaped your memory, because there are so many things, as we've touched on a lot of them today. But, you know, it's been a fascinating chat, and huge thanks for you making the time, Trevor. And like I said, we could go on forever, but the limits of my podcast are something we've now reached. So I think that's a good time to call it a day. But yeah, like I said, thanks again.
Cheers, fella. Thanks very much.
And I'll send it to you when it's up. Thank you very much.
Lovely. Yes, see ya.
Have a good rest of the day. Bye.
Yes, fella. It's all right.